petition number 21593, Rule 3.
Wingspear, Reel 3.
The petition to the north, Hill 355, was vital ground, and it stuck up in the air like the Rock of Gibraltar to the north of us. The Australian regiments held 355, which was attacked even more frequently than the Hook. The DLI held the adjacent position at one time, and General de la Billière of Gulf fame saw some service for a couple of weeks with the DLI in that position. And a friend of mine in the Hallamshires, Howard Cunningham, won a military cross as a National Service Subaltern when his platoon was attacked on the same position. The low hills between 355 and the Hook may have presented an easier target geographically to the Chinese, which was why attacks came were made on them. And the position next to the DLI one that I've just mentioned was called Nay Chon, and it was only one position up from the from Yongdong. That position, whose name, the name of which I've forgotten, was occupied by the King's Liverpool Regiment, which for a long time. And Nay Chon was of interest to me because it held a feature out in front of the two main rifle company positions where the Sergeant Bill Speakman, that I've already mentioned, won his VC when this platoon position no longer occupied, because it was dominated by the two larger hills behind. Was attacked by a battalion of Chinese, and he helped beat them off with his Bren gun, and ended up throwing beer bottles when he couldn't throw any more grenades, and inspired the troops still surviving to fight on until reinforcements managed to get through and relieve them. It was a while in that position that we started to watch the Chinese more closely. The sniper section with Tommy Noel was concentrating on new positions being built by the Chinese on the other side of No Man's Land, which is about 1,000 yards away. And I shared a hoochie with one of the snipers, Phil Seymour, with whom I'd become great friends. I was 19 and he was 36. He'd been captured on Crete by the Germans in the war, and passed through Germany and Poland as a prisoner of war, and spoke German quite well. And he was different from the average soldier, and also a good shot, and a rebel. His rebellion started in Palestine in 1936 when he was a corporal and he was ammunition storeman, and some ammunition got lost, and as armed storeman he was charged for the loss of this ammunition, and he was given a severe reprimand. Although it was the Sergeant Major's fault, and that the ammunition hadn't been checked and not his. But he knew this would affect his eligibility for a long service and good conduct medal, and he thought he'd been badly let down by the military system. And so a few months later he asked to revert to the ranks and give up his stripes, and he would never accept promotion after that. He was offered promotion many times, particularly when he was serving in the Malta Commando before Crete with Jellicoe, but he would never accept any responsibility from that day on. And he was an expert on the medium machine gun, the Vickers, as well as being a member of the battalion shooting team. But he was considered an oddity who was unwilling to make progress in the army system. However, he and I used to do various things together, and when I was sent out to map the minefields in front of Nachon, because nobody had any maps, the minefields were there on the ground, but nobody could say where they were and what they contained, and I was told to discover this and to map them and plot them. And so with a mixture of direct observation and consulting what records I could get from the Royal Engineers, whose predecessor had laid the mines, and I was able to indicate what was anti-personnel and what was anti-tank, and managed to do this without being sniped at too frequently by the Chinese, who soon learned to predict where a head might pop up next with a pair of binoculars to try to follow the red triangles on the barbed wire indicating minefields, so that I could plot them on a map enlargement that I'd made, and so we could record where in fact the minefields were, and not just take over a rifle company position, for example, and be shown the minefields without them being marked on the map. I also began training company observers at this time, and ran a two-day course at the battalion headquarters. I don't think I held any rank at that time, because I started getting promoted in unusual circumstances when I was sent off to the American Marines to do a week's course in aerial photograph interpretation, which I enjoyed. And when I got to divisional headquarters to travel from there to the Marine Division, I found that a Canadian corporal, Pete Mayon, from the Vendeuxième Régiment du Pied de Canada, was going on the same course, and he and I were the only representatives from the Commonwealth Division, and the rest were all NCOs from American infantry units and Marines. Two odd incidents from that course. When I undressed in the heated tent on the first night, one of the Marines said, "Gee, fella," he said, "what army did you say from you came from? Your underwear sure is field grey. You're sure no, you're not with the German army?" I didn't want to make too much of an excuse, but I'd been in the line 6 weeks, and we usually managed to find an excuse to march out to the brigade mobile bath unit about once a month and exchange some clothing, but the rest of the time we had to do our own washing. And in the winter, that wasn't very easy. Which leads me to Christmas in the Line on Yongdong, when our duties continued as normal, same routine, except that the sergeant majors and the sergeants in each company brought round gunfire, as it used to be called by the gunners, at 6 o'clock in the morning at Reveille. They carried a bucket of tea round all the bunkers that we lived in, two men to a bunker dug into the hillside, and served us with strong tea, heavily laced with rum. And that was all we got for Christmas Day, except for the fact that the Neffy supplied each man with a bottle of Neffy beer. We celebrated Christmas on the 5th of February. By this time, we were off Yongdong, and we became the part of the Reserve Brigade back in the divisional headquarters area, about 20 miles back south of the Imjin. And Rodney Harms had got an MC for a patrol action on Nachon. Tommy Noel had got an MM, and they went off back to England to get their medals and to take part in the coronation, which took place later that summer. Drill Sergeant Jeff Cork became intelligence officer, which wasn't as strange as it sounds for a sergeant major to do that job, because he'd been an Indian Army officer, cashiered, he told me, for sand having been found in the Demerara sugar, and as messing officer he had to carry the can for it, and he'd rejoined the British Army as in the ranks, and worked his way back up to sergeant and then to sergeant major. And so he had a background as a warrant officer which was different from most of the other senior NCOs, and he took to being intelligence officer like a duck to water. He gave me a bottle of sherry for Christmas, because by this time I've skipped ahead too much. The American Marines, the second incident was that as a good A-level student, I did my revision of my notes the night before the last day when the exam took place, and I came out top of the course with 100% on the written and 70-odd percent on the practical. And a tough old infantry sergeant from the American Army approached me and said, "Gee, fella, is all the British Army like you?" I said, "They're all a damn sight better than me. I'm a private soldier and the lowest form of life, so you can imagine what the rest are." Which I thought was a useful bit of one-upmanship on the Americans. And when I came back, the Colonel Bunbury got me in and said, "You've got a very good report and you've done extremely well. But I think I ought to tell you that this has no effect on British Army regulations, which say that aerial photographs can only be interpreted by an officer. Nevertheless, you've done very well, and I'm going to make you an acting unpaid provisional Lance Corporal." And my career began at that point. Our notables, having disappeared by this time, I found myself running the intelligence and sniper sections, because Corporal Joe Bales, whom I've already mentioned, who had come out to Korea, was a very good shot, but his temperament wasn't suited to frontline soldiering, and he was sent back to do a job at divisional headquarters because he wasn't suited to the front line. And Tommy Noel managed as sniper sergeant without an assistant, and recruited another half dozen good shots from the rest of the battalion and trained them up as snipers with Phil Seymour's assistance. I was given reinforcements for the intelligence section with the typical military method of being given first pick of the reinforcements. And I managed to pick without interview. You just walk down the ranks and pick people out, and I tried to pick the ones who looked clean or good looking or something. Anyway, I picked an engine driver who was so afraid of his situation that he had a bedwetting problem. I managed one out of four who was any good, and that was a chap named Beebe from Leeds, who'd trained as a draftsman and knew a little bit about maps. But I was given a chap from the Black Watch because he'd been thrown out of the Black Watch for no other reason, the fact that he was black as the ace of spades himself, and his grandfather had come from Jamaica two generations before and settled in Glasgow. And although he had a thick Glaswegian accent, they didn't like him in the Black Watch and gave him to the Duke of Wellington's. and he was a nice lad, but not much good with maps or weapons. On Christmas Day, 5th of February, I decided to do the duty of in the intelligence office in case anything came in and everybody else went off, and I gradually drank my way through the Jeff Corks bottle of sherry until the battle adjutant came in, Major Tony Firth, and he brought another bottle of sherry, and I got fairly well through that on my own. The only useful work I was able to do was to think what our contribution might be to the East Coast flood disaster relief fate we were going to have the following week. The floods in East Anglia had devastated whole communities at this time. And I decided I would follow my mother's example at the church fete in the village in wartime and would run a hoopla store. And we fashioned wire hoops out of metal coat hangers. And soldiers had to ring bottles of beer. And my stall, with its chance of a bottle of beer, became the most popular event at the fete, and I had all the section carrying naffy crates of Japanese beer packed in straw on their heads from the naffy to the stall pretty well permanently throughout the day. And by the end of the afternoon, my pockets were stuffed so full of naffy baths pound notes and £5 notes, that when I emptied them all on the pay officer's desk at the end of the day, including my own money, which is all tangled up with them, I managed to hand over something like £300 for the benefit of flood relief. Another odd incident occurred about this time. While we were in reserve, we were relieved by a mixed division of Americans, which included a Thailand battalion. And the Thailanders claimed that they'd been told that they would be relieved on such and such a night. And when their relieving force didn't come, they walked out anyway. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, a British Army artillery captain found himself holding the Nai Chon battalion position, where Speakman had got his VC, with two signalers and a driver, and facing the Chinese hordes opposite across the stream with no more than this, and he frantically gone on to his own radio net to get something done about it, but nobody could believe it. Until mid-morning, the message was passed on to the Duke Wellington's regiment to get somebody up there double quick time to do something about it. And for some reason, it was decided that the sniper and intelligence section, which numbered about 14 men, plus a couple of orderly room clerks, would be sent up onto the right-hand company position, and that the King's Liverpool Regiment would supply a party to the left-hand company position. And it was a bit of a race to get somebody up there quickly. And I was sent with, I was put in charge of this redeployment, which, looking back now, must have been particularly farcical. But we had two jeeps and trailers, and the weapons and ammunition were put in the trailers. And the adjutant followed up with radio sets, and we had 88 sets, and he was in contact with us. And I was sent, apparently, because I knew the ground and I knew the minefields, and nobody knew exactly how this was going to turn out, but somebody had got to get up their PDQ to, in case the Chinese tumbled to the situation and walked across in daylight, which they could easily have done. We went up through the battalion headquarters and out onto the ground, and I strung them out in a stream bed behind the company position, waiting for the adjutant's orders to go up the hill. By this time, the Chinese must have realized that something was going on, because they started mortaring the reinforcement, the route up to the forward company position. And at regular intervals, orange and black flashes of mortar explosions were occurring in the paddy field in front of us. And eventually, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I got the adjutant's order to get up there. And I'd already spread people out at about 10 yards intervals down the stream bed. And I gave the order to fix bayonets, blew my whistle, and it was prearranged. And we set off up the hill, walking through these explosions of Chinese mortars. And I'd made clear one fundamental point in the briefing. In case national service soldiers should be more impressed by American films than by the British Army tradition that the wounded will lie where they fall. And I kept looking to right and left, and could see these explosions, but they always seemed to be either in front or behind us. Anyway, we got to the communication trench at the bottom of the hill, and then doubled over the top to the observation post of the gunner captain, and I went in and told him that Mafeking was relieved, and so was he. About bloody time, he said, and I apologised, but there we were, and we waited, and at nightfall a proper relief took place, because a relief in the line normally requires two men on the ground at every point, and the first lot don't move out until the second lot are very well established, but this obviously wasn't in the standing orders of the Thailand battalion, but we got away with that without any trouble. And the two orderly room clerks were this, thoroughly enjoyed the outing. The one of them later asked to go to a rifle company, where he rapidly became a section leader as a corporal, and he didn't come back from Korea. He was killed on the Hook, in the Hook battle, where he stayed back to cover the withdrawal of his standing patrol, and was never seen again. He was a very nice lad from Leeds, but one of the casualties of the Korean War. The other thing from that, I was told to stay up there and to point out the minefields to the Vandoos, who were taking over that position the following day. In fact, they must have been the relieving battalion. And so I moved off the battalion, the company position, to the battalion headquarters. Bumped into my old pal, Pete Mayle. And at that time, the Canadian Army was the highest paid army in the world, and paid better than the Australians and the Americans. And they were playing cards in their in the battalion headquarters in the NAFI. And I was asked to join. And it became not just poker, but a form of Russian roulette, which suited me as with an interest in weapons. And I came back from that trip with two things. One, an anti-tank grenade in my pocket, which had been thrown into on the Vandoos by the Chinese, and hadn't of a type nobody had seen before. And I remember travelling back through Gloucester Valley, which is a kind of Grand Canyon in miniature, in the back of an open truck. I think it'd be March by this time, quite cold. And with this unexploded grenade rolling about on the floor, because by this time we got a bit fed up with it and were being quite blasé. And the other thing was that my pockets were stuffed full of Canadian dollars, because they were surprised to find a young British soldier who seemed to know enough about card playing to be willing to spin the chamber of a revolver and then bet on what would happen if the trigger was pulled.
Where was the gun pointed?
Well, it could be pointed at your head. Really, there's nothing to fear because the weight of the round will automatically take it low down where you wouldn't see it at all. You can only see parts of two chambers. And there's only one position where there would be any danger. And anyway, it I kept clearing the pot of